I find a lot of parallels between our attitudes toward Chinese immigration, especially in the STEM space, and this proposed ban on TikTok. In both cases, I think we're sort of cutting off our nose to spite our face, that we're abandoning not just a core value, but a core source of strength for America.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. In mid-March, the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill that would effectively ban TikTok in the United States. TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is Chinese. This bill would force ByteDance to sell TikTok to an American buyer, or else TikTok would not be available in the United States. President Biden said he would sign this bill into law, but at the moment, the legislation seems stalled in the Senate. This move to ban TikTok is ostensibly driven by national security concerns over Chinese access to user data and China's potential to use TikTok to manipulate or influence American politics. My guest today, Kaiser Kuo, argues that these anti-TikTok measures are emblematic of a moral panic around China that is increasingly taking hold among American policymakers. He is the host of the Seneca podcast, and after discussing our views on whether or not the U.S. should ban TikTok, Kaiser Kuo explains the broader international implications of this pending legislation in Congress. As always, please visit globaldispatches.org to sign up for our newsletter, get access to episode transcripts, original essays by me, and more. Thank you. Now, here is my conversation with Kaiser Kuo, host of the Seneca podcast. Let me just kick off, Kaiser, by saying how thrilled I am that Seneca is back. I am a subscriber. I encourage everyone to subscribe. It's fantastic. So I'm really pleased.
I'm honored and right back at you. I'm subscribed to you too, and I find your podcast to be an absolute delight.
I wanted to spend most of our conversation today discussing the broader international implications of a U.S. ban on TikTok and what this debate says about U.S.-China relations. But before we get there, I think it might be useful to put our cards on the table. You wrote an essay at Seneca arguing against the ban. Can you explain your reasoning?
Yeah, I mean, it's multifold, but I mean, the crux of it is that we shouldn't really try to compete with China by becoming more like China. I think we should be really upfront about what this is. There are plenty of people, including some of the sponsors of the bill who were in the House Select Committee, who've insisted that this isn't a ban and it's not about TikTok. I think that's disingenuous on both counts. First of all, TikTok is actually named very specifically in the bill. As for whether it's a ban, you could say, sighing over the keys to your automobile and you give me your pink slip or I will kill you. And say, I have not stolen it because you are now willingly giving me your vehicle. I'm going to put another driver in the seat. That's all.
I mean, as you wrote it, it is expropriation.
Yeah, I would call it expropriation. My objection to it is that this action would be tantamount to the sorts of things that China does to American social media products. There are some people who would say, well, it's just reciprocity. I don't think that we should play that game. I think that America's core strength, if anything, is openness, and not just talking about information openness, also in openness to things like immigration. I find a lot of parallels between our attitudes toward Chinese immigration, especially in the STEM space, and this proposed ban on TikTok. In both cases, I think we're sort of cutting off our nose to spite our face, that we're abandoning not just a core value, but a core source of strength for America in competition with China. If we really want to compete with China, let's lean into our strengths and do that.
You mentioned reciprocity. Many proponents of this ban have noted that indeed Google and Twitter and YouTube and even TikTok as it exists here in the United States is not accessible within China. And so proponents have said, listen, you're blocking our tech giants. We can block yours.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think there's a flawed logic in that. It's, we really want to engage China in a race to the bottom. I mean, no, I think that we need to stand for the values that we uphold and not surrender them like this. I don't think we need to destroy the village in order to save it. What's the point then? I mean, do we no longer stand for freedom of expression, for the idea that good ideas will drive out bad ideas? I mean, if we've abandoned that, let's be upfront about that, but I hope that we haven't.
So also in the interest of maybe putting our cards on the table, I'm actually don't have super strident views on this debate one way or another. I'm still persuadable and malleable. And you know, I found your essay fairly compelling, but I do see the other side of this as well. And you know, it's like not out of the realm of possibility that the TikTok algorithm is tweaked in ways that support the parochial interests of the Chinese Communist Party, which in the context of, say, very close elections here, can amount to a kind of political interference on a scale that would make Russia's 2016 meddling look quaint. So I do get those concerns. Like, how do you address or approach questions around influence operations?
So I think that it's fair that we should respond even to latent or potential national security threats. Let's just do it in a way that actually addresses those national security threats. I think that if China wants ultimately to interfere in the American electoral process, and there's reason to believe that they could, we've seen them do it in smaller countries. We've seen them do it certainly in Taiwan. Let's try to stop that from happening. But TikTok is by no means the only vector for that. In fact, it would probably be, if I were, you know, a national security operative in China, that's the last place I would do it, because it's just too obvious. And because that, if you are caught red-handed, would jeopardize the success of the singular Chinese social media product that has any traction in the United States, in fact, in the world. Why do that when there are so many other avenues available to you to do that influence? I mean, you could get the same sort of data just from data brokers. You could do operations just in the open on Twitter or on Facebook or on places where, you know, other people are likely to engage in political debate rather than, you know, being more interested in taco recipes and the latest dance moves.
So rather than like to debate the point, should the US ban TikTok or not, we don't know the outcome of this legislation. It's passed the House broadly and overwhelmingly. We don't know what will happen in the Senate. President Biden said he'd sign the bill. How is this debate and discussion and this recent action in Congress being discussed in China today? What are some of the conversations you're hearing, you're seeing?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of just sort of snarky, ironic, like, oh, the Americans are going to build a great firewall. Well, we can sell them the technology to do that. We're very good at that. Or is the United States going to create a cyberspace administration of America? You know, there's a lot of the standard sort of snarky humor, but, you know, Beijing objects to it. It's kind of ironic. I think if I were in Beijing, I would say sturm about that. I mean, why raise it when it's so blatantly hypocritical? You know, I mean, does China not block every American social media product out there? Of course they do. So, yeah, I think it's sort of strange that they've even bothered to say anything. But I think what they understand to be, and I think they correctly understand, is this isn't really driven by national security concerns. I really don't believe that it is. I think that the national security concerns are sort of appended to this or used to justify the real motivation, which is basically, I would like to poke Beijing in the eye.
Well, what makes you say that? Because, you know, there are certainly members of Congress who hold that view. I mean, you say like Mike Gallagher, for example, the outgoing Republican who's like a super China hawk. Sure. I could see that being the case. I've also heard other people, not like, you know, reflexive China hawks, actually making like a substantive national security defense in case for a ban of TikTok.
I think they've simply got it wrong. There's another alternative on the table, which actually does address those national security concerns and doesn't require the expropriation of a company. And that is Project Texas, which CFIUS signed off on, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. It's a congressional-led body. It's an independent agency, but it evaluates. It's a very, very big apparatus. Anything that might pose a national security threat that involves foreign ownership or substantial foreign stake in any American company. So CFIUS worked with Oracle and with ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, to come up with a solution to house all data on servers on U.S. soil, where the access to that data is completely controlled by a vetted group of U.S. citizens that is approved by all three parties. And I don't know what is wrong with that. Again, there's no foolproof solution, but it so raises the cost of exfiltration of data. And, you know, it so raises the odds of such an action being recognized that it would make it very unlikely that any malicious actor would try to go that route to acquire data that can then be used, you know, in influence or in any other kind of nefarious deed. It would, you know, make it make so much more sense to, you know, use the old-fashioned way of hacking or buying data from brokers or trying to do whatever it is you're trying to do through other open social media companies. I think it solves the problem.
Yeah, I mean, so to the fact that the so-called Project Texas has not been implemented, that just suggests to you that this is all part of just a growing consensus we're seeing on Capitol Hill to poke China for the sake of poking China.
That's right. I really think that there's basically an emotional impetus for this. It's not a rational one. I mean, that we have this sort of fig leaf of national security. The truth of it is, I think that we're in the throes of a moral panic. I think that that's what really is at bottom here, that something sticks terribly in the American craw about China and its rising place in the world. Now, there are many reasons behind that. Some of them, I think, are certainly less than noble.
I mean, I think I'm personally like a little more sympathetic to some of the national security concerns, just like around the influence operation side of things, not necessarily like the data harvesting, but again, like a subtle tweaks in the algorithm could, you know, influence elections in ways that we might not even be able to be perceived.
Well, let me just ask you, why would they? I mean, who do they prefer? They don't have any clear preference in the presidential race.
Well, that's a good question. Yeah.
They have no clear preference. I talk to people about this constantly. There are people who like the predictability and the relative stability of Biden, even though he has managed to really corral alliances in a way that makes life difficult for China. There are people who like Trump's transactional nature and think that his isolationist tendencies would be ultimately good for China, as well as doing damage to the U.S. I think it's a wash. I just don't think that there is any clear preference at all. This is not the 2016 race, and, you know, Xi Jinping is not Vladimir Putin. They also are so much more intertwined. They understand that there would be so much more damage that could be done to them economically in their international standing if they were caught red-handed involved in something like that. Has there been any influence operations in the United States? According to the last major intelligence report, that China has the capability to do that, but has not. That did not interfere in either the 2016 or 2020 elections. I don't see an upside for China doing that. And, you know, as far as the other things, I argued in that piece, if China is hell-bent on using these channels, and it's a very powerful channel, to influence public opinion in China's favor, has it been working? You look at the Pew, the Gallup, any other polls out there that look at American sentiment toward China, and uniformly it has been going down even as China's social media presence in the United States has been going up. So if that was the goal, it's been a singular failure.
So how do you view this debate over TikTok right now in the context of U.S. attempts to block countries from, say, adopting Huawei 5G technology, or even maybe in the context of like U.S. bans on the export to China of certain like silicone chips?
So I think that these are related, and I think that there's a much stronger case for the suspicion of Huawei. I mean, Huawei, I'm, you know, very, very persuadable that having Huawei networking equipment in our core networks is probably a very bad idea. Having it in the core networks of close American allies, you know, the Five Eyes countries, probably not a great idea. Having it in peripheral networks, that's very much debatable. But, you know, TikTok is not Huawei. TikTok does not have access to anything except the content itself, which is out in the open, and metadata, neither of which it can really do much with, neither of which it can't find easily in other places. That's not the same as actual telecommunications packets going through equipment that is owned by or operated by or is built by a Chinese tech company. So I think there's a difference, and we should not apply exactly the same logic. We have to look at it case by case.
So getting back to your core point here, that objections to TikTok center around like a burgeoning moral panic in the United States about China, Chinese influence, U.S. competition with China. I mean, are there other sort of entities or inflection points you'll be looking towards that will suggest to you like how this moral panic might unfold, particularly as we enter like the height of election season?
Silly season. We were talking
silly
about,
season. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a whole bunch of them. I mean, you know, they really, really run the gamut. You know, TikTok is just the one that's sort of above the waterline. Things like the Biosecurity Act.
What's the Biosecurity Act?
The Biosecure Act is basically, it will prevent any federally funded biotechnology company from basically using Chinese companies, from collaborating on things like doing drug screening or large-scale assays of chemistry in China, anything that has to do with biopharma or pharmaceuticals in China. It will prevent the Chinese companies, you know, companies like BGI, from doing gene sequencing for American companies. We outsourced a lot of that previously to China. Now, again, this is a very, very similar situation to the TikTok situation in that we are being very country specific about this rather than looking at a way to treat what I think is a problem that is much bigger than China, that includes problematic actors, you know, in many countries, including in the United States. I mean, this is not something to address personal biometric and health data security. It's only aimed at China. This is the same problem with, you know, the analogy is to say social media, which is problematic in ways that go way beyond TikTok, but we are using the China thing to sell it. I mean, there are, you know, more benign ways in which we've done the same thing. We sold infrastructure as competition with China. I mean, we sell basically everything legislatively in the United States now as being about competition with China. This is something that is going to be accentuated in silly season. Everything will be about competing with China, about being able to outcompete China. We've already seen the start of it. You know, we've seen versions of this pretty much in every election since 1992, but it's just getting worse.
It's funny. When I started out as a journalist, everything was sold in the context of the war on terror. And I'm just right. Like having these kind of flashbacks. Like there was this one, you know, early 2000s law, Project BioShield, which was just like, you know, a giveaway to the pharma industry that, you know, was essentially sold as a way to protect American from biological weapons. And it's the same you know, infrastructure development abroad was sold as a way to, you know, prevent the next generation of terrorists from coming abroad. So you're seeing these things kind of repeat and repeat. So I do sort of see, to a degree, your point about this being just like a moment of panic. How do we get like out of it? What are your prescriptions for getting out of this cycle of panic and just viewing China as an irredeemable threat to America?
So, I mean, obviously it takes two, right? So China is absolutely not blameless in any of this. I think the default is to see our reaction as mainly because of China's hardening. So to figure out how to get out of it, we really need to understand how we got into it in the first place. We need to tweeze apart all these different strands because there are many. There are domestic drivers in the United States. There are domestic drivers of it in China. There are, you know, mutual perceptions or inability to understand how the other side perceives our behavior. How we perceive Chinese behavior is well understood to us, but we don't really understand very well how our policy, our rhetoric, and our behavior is understood and interpreted in China, how the things we say and the things we do land on Beijing's ears, and, you know, what their priorities and their concerns are. So I think, you know, to understand how we got into it is very important. And that's one of the things that I've been doing. It's been a project crossing the last decade or more for me on the podcast, just really trying to talk through, because I really see this as really the most important thing that we need to do. People who listen to your show would probably enjoy a show that's coming out in just a couple of weeks on my show, which will be with Tom Finger, who has served in government as a diplomat in the State Department for a long time, is now at the Freeman Spogli Center in Stanford, and Mike Lampton, who is a long-serving, really very, very wise, seasoned analyst of U.S.-China relations. He was at Johns Hopkins SAIS and was the president of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations for many, many years. The two of them co-wrote an article in the Washington Quarterly. It's called U.S.-China Relations Back to the Future. And I think it is probably the best short-form explanation of why things got where they are. And, you know, to unwind that is difficult. But I think it, for me, it really boils down to one simple principle. That is this. We need to understand that there are basically two constellations of behavior in China that respond entirely to this combination of domestic and external threat. When China feels externally threatened and internally insecure, usually because, you know, they're afraid people will take to the streets, they are not only more domestically repressive, but they tend to be more bellicose, more belligerent in external matters, whether that's in coastal waters, in across the Taiwan Straits, whether it's, you know, just about anything. That's the kind of behavior we don't like, right? It's a more intolerant China domestically. It's one where minority nationalities come in for a bad time. That's the cluster of behaviors that I think any American sensibly does not want to see. It's not good for us, and it's certainly not good for China. The other cluster, though, the other constellation of behaviors is one that is absolutely more open, more tolerant, more plural even, where you tend to see more participation and more deliberation in the Chinese polity, but as importantly, it is less assertive internationally. We saw that maybe at its height after September 11th and before, say, the Olympics, and we saw that come to an end by around 2010. So I tend to focus on, you know, why one of the big factors that had China feel safe enough, even after things like the embassy bombing in 99 and the Hainan incident where an EP3 spy plane was brought down in Hainan in April of 2001. Even after these things, even after the national security establishment under Bush 42, it was clear that China was sort of topping the list of the bad guys in our mind. But then suddenly, after September 11th, it took basically a phone call. Jiang Zemin immediately reached out and said, if we're for you or against you, we are for you, if we're with you. And from that time until 2008, I would challenge you to find any substantial issue that really roiled the waters between China and the United States. So during that same period, there was maybe Darfur. We had Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham perennially banging on, as they do, about currency revaluation. We had some issues with poisoned pet food and some drywall that was problematic installed in some houses in Florida. But other than that, U.S.-China relations really were smooth sailing. And at the same time, China domestically became much more liberal. There were massive expansion of media, of a public sphere, a massive expansion of individual liberties. We saw a lot of the old Leninist hierarchical systems come crumbling down. I mean, it was a fantastic time to live in China. And I think, you know, getting back to that, is it comes down to really kind of one thing. Less is more. The less we obsess on China, the less China becomes something obsession worthy.
We'll have to leave it there. That's a great line to end it on. Thank you so much for your time as always, Kaiser.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.